I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Join us as we explore health, community, and culture from a holistic perspective. Health topics addressed on our show are for information and entertainment and should not be taken as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us. I'm Kevin Middleton here with Samantha Berg, and tonight we've invited longtime animal advocate and visionary Michael Mountain to join us here for an in-depth look at the complex relationship between humans and animals. Michael is the former president and founder of Best Friends Animal Society, a national nonprofit organization which helped catalyze the no-kill movement for companion animals in the 1980s. Nearly 30 years ago, when Best Friends helped launch and pioneer the no-kill movement, over 15 million homeless pets were dying in our nation's shelters. Today, that number is down to around 3 million unnecessary deaths annually. So we want to discuss Michael's history in the no-kill movement for companion animals, and we also want to take a look at the current state of the animal protection movement for all other kinds of animals. Michael says the phrase animal rights is actually a contradiction in terms, and we want him to elaborate on that, and we want to hear about his current work to rectify the unnecessary suffering of animals in the Non-Human Rights Project.
So before we introduce Michael, I'd like to give you a little bit of information about his background. So Michael Mountain began his work in animal protection in the late 1970s. He became one of the founders and the president of Best Friends Animal Society. And in the 1990s, he helped launch the no-kill movement at a time when more than 15 million homeless pets were being killed in shelters every year. Today, that number is below 3 million a year. But while the situation for dogs and cats has improved enormously, the situation for other animals has only gotten worse. So today, Michael works with various animal protection groups, including the Non-Human Rights Project, which is working towards actual legal rights for non-human animals, which we'll be talking about later. And he's also a director of the Camilla Center for Animal Advocacy, which applies science and scholarship to animal advocacy. Michael maintains a daily blog at earthtransition.org, where he comments on things in the news related to our rapidly changing world, and he's also on Twitter at earthtransition.
And welcome to the show,
welcome
Michael.
Welcome to the show, Michael. Great to have you here.
Nice to be with you from down here in sunny southern Utah near the Grand Canyon.
Great. So, Michael, does not everyone love animals? I mean, isn't there just something naturally in a human being that sees a certain innocence, a certain wonder and beauty and wildlife and fuzzy little critters and kitty cats and fuzzballs? These wonderful beings are our friends, no doubt. But how is it that we've come to have such a harmful and oftentimes it's just a cruel relationship with these animals?
I think it probably begins with the fact that we sometimes lose track of the fact, Kevin, that we actually are animals. You know, we talk about humans like we're sort of something else sometimes. And so when we start losing touch with nature all around us, then we actually start losing touch with some of our own nature too. And once that distance is in there, I think things go kind of weird.
And it's interesting that we're always longing for that connection. You have this amazing picture on your website. It's a few stories down at the earthintransition.org site. It's titled Swan Song, and it's a picture of a man with a swan, and the swan's neck is literally wrapped around this man's neck. And the quote is, "It's a wonderful moment when an animal totally trusts you." Born to Explore TV show host Richard Wise says, "When I put the swan next to me, I could feel her heart beating, and she just relaxed her neck and wrapped it around mine." And he goes on to say in the story where this was a swan that had had flown into a fence and was needing to be rescued. And this guy, the picture of this guy with the swan wrapped around his neck, and he's just got his eyes closed, and he's just sort of taking in that connection with another living being. It's such a beautiful picture. And then you contrast that with what goes on in factory farms or the abuse that occurs, you know, with companion animals all over the world. It's just, it's hard. There's such a huge disconnect there.
Yes. That's true. But I think for most of us, you know, leave aside kind of people who are psychotic or whatever, when we're actually close up with any other kind of animal, we do have that connection. And certainly, obviously, with dogs and cats. I mean, when you rescue a stray cat or dog, or maybe a dog who's been hit by a car in the road or whatever, then there's a, just a natural bond of understanding and empathy and whatever that I think almost anybody has. And when we talk about the factory farms, then when people actually see what goes on in a factory farm, they're absolutely horrified. I mean, the picture that we want to have of, you know, cows and pigs and turkeys and chickens and so on is something that's kind of bucolic, that's nice, that's kind of natural again. So those feelings, I think, are there for all of us.
So let's talk about a little bit of the history of the no-kill shelter movement and how you got involved in it, the state of where things were at when there were 15 million companion animals being killed every year in this country, what you saw, how you got involved in it, and how you were able to get things to evolve over time and change to where we're at now, where there's only 3 million animals being killed, which is still a huge number, but it's quite a change from where we were back when you started.
And what were some of the obstacles that you faced in that process?
Yeah, well, it's certainly a dramatic change that's happened over the last 20 years. I mean, just things just could not be more different from the way they were. Just a little background, you know, from my end of this, I kind of grew up, I was a teenager in the 1960s, and I dropped out of Oxford University, as a lot of people were dropping out of things back then. It was kind of fun and wild time, and came together with a group of people, and we wanted to, as everybody did in the 1960s, you know, save the world and whatever, and we went into politics, and we started our own religion at one point, and we got into psychology, and we got into whatever. But that all concluded with a kind of general understanding among us that we might not be able to save the world, but we could certainly do something for all of the other kinds of animals. And over in this country, then, some years later, I was actually living down in Phoenix, Arizona, in the mid to late 1970s, and became involved with the humane societies and the different animal rescue organizations that were going on. And that was when you kind of begin to understand that almost everything, I mean, you know, for any dog or cat going into a shelter, it was really a one-way trip. I mean, you didn't come back out alive. And we started we acquired a small ranch, and we started bringing some of the dogs and cats who had the least chance of finding their way into a new home, and found just how incredibly easy it was to rehabilitate them, to, you know, get them into a situation where we could put them into new homes. And having found that, we went looking for a great place to start a larger sanctuary of our own, and found it here in southern Utah, and again began bringing in some of the hardest to adopt dogs and cats from locally, from other places, from other shelters, far and wide, in fact, and ended up with many, many hundreds of them, and that led into, well, you know, we can't go on doing this. So we started spay neuter programs and adoption programs that really didn't exist at that time at all. But the kind of dogs and cats who were coming to us at Best Friends in the early days, you know, one of the early ones I remember was, let's say, Benton the cat, who was a sweet little gray cat who had been left behind when his family moved to a new home and decided they didn't want to take him with them. So as they were driving off to their what was going to be their new home, Benton went running down the street to try to catch up with the car and got hit by another car. Well, he wasn't badly hurt. He was kind of rescued by a neighbor. One of his legs just didn't work. He had one gammy leg, a kind of club foot, and one bad eye that couldn't see. Now, today, a cat like Benton, who was a sweet little fellow, would be adopted into a new home, you know, like tomorrow. I mean, it's just those kind of cats just aren't a problem to, you know, place in new homes. back then, a cat like Bentham with one eye, three legs, whatever, that was just automatically, you wrote on the report at the shelter, unadoptable, and 3 days later, if he hadn't been just, you know, adopted, which was most unlikely, he would have been put down. So that was sort of the general mindset back then, and I'm talking about in the early 1990s. And I think for us, the real challenge then, and it was not a difficult challenge because, you know, with cats like Benton, it's easy to write a story about them and have a nice photo, and it became almost, I think by the late 1990s, it was becoming sort of fashionable almost for people to adopt a rescued, homeless, stray dog or cat, whereas before that, it was sort of fashionable always to have a dog or cat who was what they would call a pure breed. But the whole thing began to turn around, and most people today are very happy to adopt rescue cats and dogs, and a little bit leery of saying, well, you know, I didn't adopt this cat, I actually bought him from the store. So that's the extent that the whole kind of relationship has really changed. You know, people feel it's the right thing and it's a good thing, and they feel very happy to have a rescued dog or cat in their home.
You know, it's interesting to me, that's just that's a given, just my own. So somewhere along the way, that's a cultural attitude that had shifted by the time I, you know, grew up. And I'm just curious, you know, how do we pioneer a change in cultural attitude around something like that? I mean, is that something that you could say purely was the result of your efforts in the Best Friends Animal Society, or did you all sense, you know, an emerging trend and you know, the larger cultural climate of greater consciousness and sensitivity to other people and civil rights, and just there was a general atmosphere in the culture that seemed prime for this?
I'd certainly say that the time was right. I mean, we weren't doing, you know, this was not all being generated from us. It was one of these, you know, usual sort of stories that there was, the time was right, and there were groups, mostly grassroots groups, just beginning to spring up all over the country. There was Richard Avanzino, who was an attorney in San Francisco, and he decided around 1995 that he was absolutely going to turn San Francisco into a no-kill city. And he started working that end of it. And there were people who were starting programs for feral cats, so that instead of just deciding that all feral cats should be exterminated on site or whatever, which was sort of the prevailing attitude, there were people starting what they called trap, neuter, and return programs, by which you get the cats spayed and neutered, and then you put them back out where they belong, and they would live comfortably, and you gradually, just through spaying and neutering them, you'd reduce the whole feral cat population. So there were all these different things kind of going on at the same time, and yes, it all really began to come together.
It's interesting what you're saying, because I actually worked at the Anchorage Animal Control Center in, I think it was around 1996 or 97. I spent about 6 months there as a kennel technician. So I saw exactly what you're talking about. There's quite a bit of kind of grassroots organizations coming in. There was one organization in particular, Friends of Pets, and they would come in and ask us as the kennel technicians, which are the animals here that look like they might be getting sick or that you think might be a little bit challenged in terms of being adopted, and they would really make an effort to try to find foster homes for those animals. And then I also saw a fair number of breed-specific rescue groups starting to come up. So that was going on while I was there. And then also interesting that you mentioned the feral cats, because at the time, the Anchorage facility had just been taken over by, had been privatized, so it was no longer being run by the state. So I'm not sure about all the ins and outs about that transition, but they did have a room just devoted to the feral cats. And having worked with those animals, it's really hard for me to imagine how you were able to convince anyone that it was a good idea to keep the feral cats alive, because those animals were probably, I would go head to head with a pit bull any day before I would take on a feral cat without, you know, full gear. So the feral cats were probably the scariest animals that I worked with, because they really had reverted to being wild animals. So, and at any given time, we could have anywhere from, you know, 5 to 20 feral cats going on at the animal shelter, especially in the summer in Anchorage. So it would be interesting to hear more about that, what went on in that transition, like how you were able to work that. And also a little bit about what you're saying now that seems so commonplace, that all the shelter animals now have a photo on the internet and a little bio and something from the technicians who are working with the animals up on the internet, so people can now browse through the animals at the animal shelter without actually having to go there. And back when I was working there, you still had to go into the shelter and look at the individual animals. You weren't able to shop online.
There was a particular aspect of it, which was just how the shelters and humane societies just overall were kind of presenting themselves to, you know, the general public, like their members or people who might have sent a donation once or people on their mailing list. And I remember very distinctly, you know, in the early 1990s and before that, you get, you may have seen this, I'm sure a lot of people listening to this at home have had the experience of getting a letter through the mail, and there's this photo on the envelope of a scraggly, thin, maybe injured dog or whatever, and inside it says, unless you can help, this dog will die in a few days or whatever, and the whole situation is so terrible, and please help and give what you can, and so on. And of course, people's reaction, I mean, very understandably, you know, you kind of send a donation, you send $25 or something to help, but next time you get an envelope like that through the mail, you try to forget about it and drop it in the trash, because you just don't want to read all of this kind of unpleasant, horror, sad, depressing stuff. So a lot of it from the, if you like, the whole promotional side, which I was very much involved in, was about really just changing the whole way we communicated with people, rather than talk about all the sad, dreadful things about some poor cat or dog. You want to show how the whole situation for them has turned around, and when you bring this cat or dog into your home, she's going to be, you know, such a blessing because she's so loving and caring and so on. And people, this started to just sort of changing the whole relationship to it all. And a lot of this was coming then from, as you were saying, from the grassroots groups. And that was really the, I think, the most interesting, I don't know, sociological or whatever you would call it, side of things, that it was really coming from, you know, down there at the grassroots, not from the top. In fact, it was the big, established, well-known organizations out there who were among the very last to actually change. All of this was driven from below.
Wow. Now,
I think that's the same probably in most of these kind of cultural, you know, change movements. I mean, you were talking about civil rights and so on, Kevin, just before. Wasn't that pretty much the same thing?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's really encouraging, because right now we're in a time where the capacity to come together at the grassroots level is more powerful and more available than ever before.
Well, exactly. I mean, this is the internet in those terms has changed everything. And so, you see this on the worldwide level. It's not all perfect. It's not all working out. But, you know, everything that we were seeing in the famous Arab Spring and all of this kind of stuff, and what's happening just in general politics in this country on the day-to-day level.
Yeah. You're listening to Michael Mountain, and we're talking about the human relationship to animals. And if you have a question for Michael, You can Facebook us. Just go ahead to Bridge to Everywhere and just type your question in on our page, and we'll ask it on the air.
And speaking of just changing attitude, it sounds like what we're talking about here is just changing the way people think about the problem. You know, and changing, not just changing the way people relate to animals, but changing the way people think about how you would want, how you would encourage someone to adopt an animal. It's funny when you mention that card that someone gets in the mail in showing an animal that's in a desperate state, and that immediate visceral reaction to want to look away and not face it because it feels like it's somehow overwhelming. But if you can find a way to present it in a different way, it actually can open someone's heart, and they can actually see, oh, well, I can make a difference in that one animal's life. You know, there's something that I can do here. But somehow that other strategy that seems like, you know, it might get a donation from somebody on the one time actually turns people off and keeps people at a distance. So there's that fine line that you have to walk between helping people open their hearts and see that they can actually participate and make a difference, and then giving too much and having people turn away because they can't handle it.
And also helping people to see, yes, when you say how they can make a difference in every way, because again, at the grassroots level of this, it wasn't all about simply, you know, sending in your donation and somebody in Washington, D.C. or New York or whatever was going to do something about it. I mean, you know, everybody could participate right there at the local level, just like the folks who were coming in, you know, from that rescue group that you talked about, Sam.
Friends of Pets,
yeah. The way you were working,
right.
Yeah.
Michael, are there numbers decreasing in the number of animals that are left off at shelters? Any sense of that? Has that changed?
Sorry, say that again. I missed something when you asked that.
I'm curious, you know, so there's a decrease in the number of unnecessary deaths.
Right, yes.
But is there a trend in the numbers of animals being dropped off at animal shelters? Is that changing?
Oh, certainly, yeah. That is very largely to do with spay-neuter programs, which were really very minimal back again in the early 1990s. So you had all of these sort of backyard births going on and people bringing litters of puppies to shelters, and that is remarkably less today than it was then, just enormously so, yeah.
Seems like the situation, though, of what you described with that one cat with the family deciding to leave and then last minute thinking, like, well, I guess we can't take the cat with us. I wonder if that's changed at all, because that, again, was something that I saw working at the shelter. I can't tell you how many animals were dropped off. We have a rather large military population up here in Alaska, and so a lot of times it was military people being relocated overseas, and they couldn't take their animals. So there's a lot of moving in and out of the state, though, and many times we would get letters with people dropping off animals overnight, just saying, well, you know, we moved and we don't have a place for our dog or our cat. And that was always so sad to me, because there would be people who, you know, in some cases the animals had been with the family for all their lives. That's all they knew. And then they would drop them off at the shelter and they'd have to start all over again. So I'm wondering if that particular issue has changed or if that has not. Any idea on that?
It's all changed to a greater or lesser extent. Certainly in the military, you still get some of what you were talking about. And there was really quite a new big issue that just came up a few years ago when the whole housing market collapse thing happened, and there were a lot of people being foreclosed on, and the whole mortgage crisis and all of that. And what you had then in many parts of the country was people who had to leave their homes, and they just couldn't, as far as they were concerned, take their pets with them, and they would leave them, you know, in the house.
And the other thing I saw was, which I didn't thought about before, was during Hurricane Katrina, for instance. I never even thought about when a natural disaster comes through, the number of people that are separated from their pets. And so there was we were donating money to the Red Cross, and I happened to come across an organization called Noah's Wish. And there were an organization that was helping people after a natural disaster like a hurricane get reunited with their pets, and operating temporary shelters for pets that generally people were being rescued off off of rooftops, but they weren't able to take their animals with them. So that's something that we often don't think about, but it does happen when there's a natural disaster that people can get separated from their pets, and they're not intending to leave their pets. Or I even heard a story about a woman who left her home not expecting that the hurricane was going to be bad and that she would be back in, 24 hours, and the cat was left. And fortunately, the cat was rescued by a neighbor, so those kinds of situations happen. So we still have to deal with those.
Yeah, we had a big rescue shelter down in New Orleans, two shelters, in fact, and it was just the most bizarre, I guess, kind of situation. I mean, you go out in boats up and down the streets of the city and the surrounding areas and so on, and you'd see mainly, to a large extent, that they were pit bulls who'd been chained to a car or literally onto the roof or whatever, and they were just standing there on the roofs of houses just above the water line, and rescuing them all and getting them into the boats and getting them back to the shelters and sending them off right across the country. I mean, in some, some cases, we were able to charter whole planes to actually get hundreds of dogs at a time across to different shelters who were willing to take them all across the country. It was just an amazing rescue effort altogether.
That's incredible to hear that. It's just not something that we, it sort of goes on underneath the radar unless you're involved in it. It wasn't something, I had to look for it to know that it was going on. So it's so fascinating to me that that's, I mean, and obviously it has to go on, but it probably, I mean, I can't imagine what happened in hurricanes in the 60s and 70s, that infrastructure wasn't in place probably, and those animals just perished.
Yeah.
So Michael, how do we take that incredible energy, passion, and love for companion animals and extend it to all the rest?
I think there's a particular barrier in the way, which is that we have a relationship with companion animals, dogs and cats in particular, by which we've sort of made them part of the family. And there's obviously a very good side to that. There's a bit of a downside to that, too, because sometimes we treat them as if they're little babies, people who like to dress up their baby dogs or whatever, and sort of treat them like small humans, which is not actually good for dogs and cats. But overall, they are part of what scientists would call our in-group. And most other kinds of animals aren't. Wildlife and food animals and farmed animals, that we eat and so on, we kind of keep them at a distance, and we just don't have the same relationship. And the simple fact is that as much better as the situation is for dogs and cats over the last 20 years, let's say, it is actually that much worse for other animals. And this is just, sad fact of life, which is that we're now actually, quite apart from anything else, in the middle of what scientists refer to as a sixth great extinction of life. I mean, we're just looking at thousands of species, starting with the big iconic ones that we all know so well, like the elephants and the gorillas and our closest cousins, for heaven's sakes, the chimpanzees. I mean, as things stand in the wild in 50 years' time, there will be no chimpanzees. And that is what we are doing to our own, our own cousins in these terms. And that is just difficult to contemplate. And those are the big ones and the small ones as well, just frogs of all kinds everywhere. And the whole kind of natural system is being disrupted at the moment. And we're seeing just thousands of species at a time going extinct. And nothing like this has happened, literally, since the last great extinction, which was the extinction of the dinosaurs 65 million years ago.
Michael, I'm going to interrupt you for a moment. We're going to take a brief break for station identification,
okay,
and we'll be right back. We're on Bridge to Everywhere, and we're speaking with Michael Mountain about the complicated relationship between animals and humans. We'll be right back.
KVRF Sutton, Radio Free Palmer.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Bridge to Everywhere, and we are speaking with Michael Mountain. We were talking about the complicated relationship between humans and animals. And Michael was just in the process of talking about, although things have gotten much better for companion animals, dogs and cats, and we've seen some huge strides in the past 20 years of how we treat those animals. Unfortunately, things have gotten worse for all other animals, so animals that we use for food and clothing, and also exotic animals, and basically all of the big iconic animals like chimpanzees and tigers and bears and elephants and rhinos. Things have gotten incredibly worse all over the world, and that's directly due to human actions. So we want to talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, and not only that, but also all of the layers of life in the ecosystem. You know, you brought up the frogs, and immediately I'm thinking deforestation. I'm thinking about water pollution. I'm thinking about all the different ways that the atmosphere is being changed. The landscape is being changed from human industry. So it really is top down, all the way, just top to bottom, isn't it?
And there's just such an enormous human population, you know, 7 billion of us and counting at the moment. And the planet just cannot support this level of, economists always talk about the need for growth. But there are other people in the both in the economic world and the ecological world who say, well, hold on, you know, I mean, we just sort of take for granted that we should just go on kind of growing. But the planet cannot support this. I mean, we are running out of fish in the oceans. We're running out of forests. We're running out of breathable air. We're running out of actually fresh water in many parts of the world. Over the next few years, something is going to seriously have to change, or the planet itself, I'm putting it crudely, can kind of throw us off, you know, just like...
A virus?
Oh, yes.
Perhaps, yeah. Just like a virus?
I'm afraid so. It can. And in those terms, you know, there's not a whole lot. You know, when we're talking about the dogs and cats, I mean, it's very easy for anybody to help, you know, to get their pets fixed, to adopt a dog or cat rather than going to the pet store or whatever. But when we're looking at this, you know, big overall picture, it gets much more complicated than that.
Well, we're asking people, and ourselves, I'm sure a lot of people out there already know that it's something like if everyone in the world were to consume on the level that the U.S. consumes, maybe it's just all developed countries, I think we need something like 7 to 10 planets to support our level of consumption. So, and as far as we know, we only have one. So we really need to think about things in different ways, and we're being asked to change how we do things and how we approach things. And I think, the next 20, 30 years, I don't even know if we start changing now, if it's going to be enough, and still we have to change. And so we're asking people to make some pretty serious changes in what's considered normal consumption in our lifestyle, in the choices that we make, and it's getting into really core issues, cultural things that we're looking at, just what people consider normal in their day-to-day life. Just the fact that you can turn on a faucet and get clean water in this country, you know, even that may change. So what do you see some of the overarching issues being? How do we get people to open their eyes and wake up and do something different?
I think one of the big things that we can all do is there's just an assumption these days that that eating food that comes from factory farms is just the normal thing to do. But I absolutely suggest to people who say, you know, what's one thing I can do? And I say start moving toward, I mean, you don't have to go, as it were, cold turkey, excuse the turkey word on that, all at once. But we do an enormous amount of good for the animals and an enormous amount of good for ourselves. And as you guys know, when we switch to a more plant-based diet and simply don't support the factory farms. I know you guys have talked about this on the Bridge to Everywhere, you know, quite recently about what goes on in factory farming and all of the completely unnecessary antibiotics that the animals are being given there and just the way they're treated just generally. And, I mean, right now, I mean, this week, you know, for the last 2 weeks, we're looking at another of these terrible bird flu outbreaks. H7N9 is this latest one that's going on in China right now. And it's just in its very early stages, and we don't know exactly, but it may just peter out, like a number of them do. Or you may have, I mean, a real-life version of the movie Contagion. I mean, you know, one day something like this will happen. And the thing about it is that these things don't just happen by chance. They happen because of these shocking conditions that the animals are kept in these huge kind of intensive farming situations. And you get the birds then mixing it up with the pigs, and the pigs are just one of these great vectors whereby they can get a bird virus from one side and a human virus from the other side, mix them up and turn it into something which is easily transmissible, and you know that goes off into a whole other story there. But you know, we are just setting ourselves up for serious trouble here. And what it all comes back to again, remarkably, there's something almost sort of karma-like about it, which is that if one of those contagion-type situations happens, it will be a direct consequence of the way we have been treating the animals in these factory farms.
I noticed you had an article on your website about that there's some legislation right now that's trying to prevent people being able to go into factory farms and film what's going on, and that there seems to be some sort of backlash, which is then people saying that there should always be cameras inside a factory farm, you know, like 24/7 webcams, so people can see at any given moment. I can tune in to my local factory farm and say, hey, I wonder what's going on with the cows or the pigs or the chickens. And if that were to be the case, I think things would shift around rather quickly. And I also want to mention that the interview that we did about factory farming was with David Kirby about his book Animal Factory, and he mentioned on the show that it was just a matter of time until some kind of major pandemic virus showed up with the way that we treat the animals and just the conditions that we keep them in. So I think we had that conversation about 3 weeks ago.
He felt that one of two things would basically amount to change in the factory farming industry. One would be a catastrophic virus outbreak. The other would be something of a crisis in the grain pricing. So the whole economic model to support generating protein in that whole system would be inequitable. Like it just, or wouldn't be profitable. So, you know, what's more likely in those two scenarios? I don't know. But the other option here, and I just don't know that it's enough. But is consumer sentiment changing? And there is one example of that fairly recently with New Zealand, I think, or it was Australia. Where their two largest grocers refused to carry factory farm products any longer. They completely phased out, and that was a really incredible sign.
Yes, there are changes like that happening. Whether it's enough, and that's a whole other question. But then underlying this, you still have this fact that, if we saw what was going on, then obviously, we wouldn't, we'd be shocked and horrified. But people actually do know what's going on, and we do make that choice ourselves just to shut ourselves away from it, and we prefer not to know. And it's difficult, it's painful, it's whatever, but there is one thing we can do about it. You know, once you know what's going on, you do not have to patronize these places. That's why I will say, for your own health, just apart from anything else,
absolutely.
Which more and more just start moving over to plant-based. I mean, more and more people are doing it, and they're saying, wow, it's just made a huge difference to my health, to my heart, to my I don't need to tell you guys that. Right.
But you know, when we spoke to David Kirby, we talked about it from purely, really, from a health standpoint. You know, from a health standpoint in terms of the animals' health and how it was affecting the community health and also the people that are eating the food because they are, you know, not because they're in such close quarters, they're pumped full of antibiotics and antifungals, and they're also fed genetically modified grains, and you know, so this is not a healthy situation for the animals or for the people. But you know, so you can make that choice even if it's not a moral choice. But what we're talking about here with you is more about the looking at the morality of doing what we do, and it's interesting that we make this choice in a way because we can. You know, we as humans, we are able to do this, and so because we are able to do it, we go ahead and do it. Somebody comes up with a really good idea on how to make more money farming cattle or growing pigs or chickens, and then that you know, somebody puts that idea through the you know, looks at the economics of it, and the bean counters come in and say, hey, you know, we can produce that chicken instead of $1.20 a pound, it's only going to cost us 67 cents a pound. And so when we're thinking about things purely through an economic model, things that make sense financially don't necessarily make sense on a whole bunch of other levels. So we're going to have to start looking at not just from a health standpoint, but and then ultimately from a morality level, like, is this the right thing to do anymore, or do we know enough to know that this is wrong?
Yeah, and it's strange. I mean, when you think about pigs in particular, pigs make wonderful pets. They're also incredibly intelligent. And, you know, a pig's life in the factory farm is definitely no fun. But there's the famous quote by Winston Churchill who said, a dog looks up to you, a cat looks down on you, only a pig treats you as an equal.
That's awesome.
And all of these, you know, cows, I mean, you know, for thousands of years have been seen as the great mother figures of mythology. And they are. They're deeply emotional, sensitive, loving, caring, and they should be able to, you know, live their lives in that way.
And that's a great segue to maybe begin looking at the Non-Human Rights Project and maybe to talk a little bit about the state of human rights and your statement that that's a contradiction in terms.
You mean the state of animal rights?
Yeah.
Animal rights,
yeah. What did I say?
Human rights.
Oh.
The state of animal rights is what we want to talk about. So where are we going in terms of animals getting rights? What's that process? And let's talk specifically about the Non-Human Rights Project and how they're going to approach that.
But you know, there are a lot of organizations that talk about, you know, being animal rights organizations, and we talk about the animal rights movement and so on, but it's kind of ironic because actually no animals other than humans have any rights actually at all. There are some laws that are passed then that will protect maybe a dog from being abused or something like that, but the dog herself has actually no rights at all. And when I stepped out of Best Friends and I was looking for, you know, something to become involved in that would really make a difference for all the other animals, and I came across, I'd actually known him kind of on and off for a few years, but I became a little more involved with the work of an attorney called Stephen Wise, who has been studying this for many years, and he actually wrote the book on how the whole law began to change in relation to slaves back in the 18th and 19th centuries. And the same way that was approached is the way that we at the Non-Human Rights Project now are starting to, you know, to apply this to non-human animals. And the story, if you'll bear with me for a moment, it goes back to 1769 when a guy called Charles Stewart, who was a slave owner in Virginia, and he took his slave James Somerset over to London, England. Somerset escaped and was then recaptured and was put on a slave ship and chained up on a slave ship in the River Thames, bound for the sugar plantations of Barbados. But he'd already found some people who cared about him and a group of attorneys who wanted to help and so on, and they went to court arguing that James Somerset needed to be recognized as a, what you call in quotes, a legal person, not a legal thing, because slaves, as we know, were viewed not as persons, but as pieces of property that could be owned by someone, and therefore they had absolutely no rights at all. Obviously, don't need to explain all of that in detail. You know all about that.
Well, which I would like to point out and add in there that, that women were in a similar situation, you know, even 200 years ago, they were just property. So that things have changed quite a bit.
Yes. Yeah. And children, you know, who could be just taken off and put in, treated as child labor, and they had no rights either. And there are arguments going on today as to whether unborn babies have particular rights or not. So this is all still going on in relation to the whole human population. But the famous judge Lord Mansfield in London, this was then in 1772, this was 3 years later, finally agreed that James Somerset was a legal person, that he could not be held against his will if he hadn't committed a crime, and he set him free. And that set in motion a whole series of similar cases in courts up and down the United States that went on for almost 100 years. And in the northern states, the judges tended to agree that the human in question, the slave, was a legal person. And in the South, the judges tended not to agree with that, and so that took, you know, that took everything eventually to a civil war. But nobody would say today, at least most people wouldn't say today, that just because of your skin color or your gender or your age or whatever, you are not a person with rights of your own. So the final barrier on this, as far as we would be concerned now, is that we need to start applying this step by step to all kinds of other animals. If you take a chimpanzee, for example, who's sitting in a laboratory, and she may be a 45-year-old mother who's perfectly capable of actually communicating and literally in English through a computer, we may not be able to speak chimpanzee, but chimpanzees actually learn to speak English. And when you take all of the characteristics of what makes us persons as opposed to just things in those terms, they all apply to chimpanzees, they apply to elephants, and they apply, as we know, is very close to the hearts of you guys, to dolphins and orcas. So the idea that you can have orca who is a killer whale who has been taken from the wild or born in captivity and pen them up in a small pool so that people can be entertained by them when these are sentient, caring, loving, intelligent, emotional beings, and all of this has been proved. I mean, that they are self-aware, that they are as much persons in those terms as we humans are. And the fact that we treat them like something else that exists simply to entertain us or to be experimented on or to be made money out of or whatever is absolutely unconscionable. And so the whole non-human rights project exists to start going to court in exactly the same way as people did for James Somerset and then the other slaves and other individual people, and say, look, here's the evidence, here's why this this particular orca or elephant or chimpanzee or whatever is a person in those terms, and the person holding them in captivity has no right to do that, and we require on their behalf that they be set free.
So can I interrupt for a sec? I just want to summarize for our listeners so they get where we're going with this. And because I heard Stephen Wise speak last summer on the San Juan Islands, and he talked a little bit about this. And so what you're saying is that we're looking at the animals that we can say that demonstrate the qualities that we would consider most human-like, you know, ability to recognize themselves in a mirror, the level of social interaction that they have, these particular animals that we could start here and actually designate these animals as non-human persons. And then based on that designation, once you have that designation, then you have rights, then you're no longer property. But up until that point, if you're still property of someone else, like, and to take the example of the orca that you use, right now the killer whales at SeaWorld are the property of SeaWorld. So they can do with them whatever they want. They can move them anywhere. They can do whatever they choose because they belong to SeaWorld. But if we took one particular orca, for example, and said, okay, this orca we are now designating as a non-human person, and that makes that orca not the property of the corporation anymore. And now that animal basically has a container into which we can put rights into, correct? And,
yeah. Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah,
sorry.
Exactly so. And while, you know, your killer whale or other kind of, or other dolphin at SeaWorld has certain legal protections. I mean, you can't, you know, shoot her or whatever or abuse her in certain ways. That in no way makes up for the fact that she is still, putting it very simply, enslaved. She has no rights of her own. And she can never have any rights. And people sometimes get this a little bit confused when we talk about it and say, well, why are you talking about giving other kinds of animals human rights? Well, of course, we're not talking about human rights at all. We're talking about dolphin rights or we're talking about elephant rights. And those rights are very simple and straightforward, like any, like they have the right to what we call bodily liberty, which means you can't lock them up and take them captive or take them away from their families, and bodily integrity, which means if they're like a chimpanzee in a laboratory, you can't poke them, you can't do invasive research on them, you can't. So you have bodily liberty and you have bodily integrity. And those are the simple, basic rights that really relate to all species, but in particular to these self-aware, emotional, sensitive, highly intelligent animals who know that they're being kept in captivity and they understand what's happening to them. And it's really no different for them than it is for any of us if we're being held captive against our will and for no good reason.
Michael, for medical research, what is the current state of technology? Can we proceed with the kind of life-saving research for human health and no longer require chimpanzees? Are we capable of really moving beyond this from that standpoint?
Well, as far as chimpanzees are concerned, Kevin, actually the National Institutes of Health has already decided that doing invasive research on chimpanzees is entirely unproductive and is moving right now to have all of the chimpanzees that they own actually moved to sanctuaries. But I'm kind of radical on this myself. I go with the author Mark Twain, who wrote about 100 years ago. He said, I care not whether... I don't have the exact quote in my head, but it was basically, I care not, it makes no difference to me whether doing research on this or that animal will have any noticeable benefit for me. The fact, very simply, is that it is wrong and we shouldn't do it. And we would apply exactly the same rationale to that as we would to doing research on unconsenting human beings. And that, incidentally, has been done too. And, of course, it was it produced some quite good research. But this was done in Nazi concentration camps. It was actually done in this country as well in a famous series of experiments in the 1950s through, I think, the 1970s. And if something is just wrong, then you stop doing it, and then you find other ways. There's lots of arguments as to whether vivisection, you know, experimenting on animals, produces any good for humans, and that's a much longer debate than we could get into here. But most of the things, I think we all know, that are actually wrong, you know, most of the sicknesses, the illnesses that that we humans suffer from today have really nothing to do with anything that you can learn from in relation to other kinds of animals. You know, their heart disease and cancer and diabetes, and they're all to do with the way we live our lives. If we all lived our lives better, then millions of us would live to a much healthier old age, and none of this research would be relevant, necessary, or ever even done.
So yes. We go back to the plant-based diet again. So yeah. We keep coming back to being a conscious consumer and being, the more, the better we take care of ourselves, then we don't need to be doing this research. And when you were speaking, I was thinking about that there still are our personal care products, cosmetics and otherwise that are tested on animals, and that's also completely unnecessary. You know, finding new and better chemicals that are toxic, or we want to see the level of toxicity and how much of it then we can put in the product before we might harm someone, and we're subjecting animals like rabbits, to big stuff being put on their skin or in their eyes. I mean, that absolutely needs to stop, because there's ways of making cosmetic products already. I mean, I know plenty of people who make their own soap and make their own shampoo and make their own, you name it, personal products. So there's no reason for us to be adding all of the chemicals to our personal care products that we have to test on animals. And then this also causes issues for the planet, because it ends up in the groundwater and it ends up, so it always comes, it keeps coming back to an issue of, how we choose to do life and, when is enough enough. And do we need to find the next new and better smell or flavor or whatever it is for our for our personal use, or do we already know it? Do we already know as much as we need to know, and should we just back off of that?
Yeah. And I wanted to add one more thing to that. And I think that there's a hidden cost to this to human beings, and that's the cost of conscience. I mean, when we're actually, there is a price I think to be paid when we're participating in something that we really know is wrong on a deep level. And even though it might be culturally endorsed, culturally accepted, and it's a matter of convenience, but there is something that's the gap between what we know and how we live, I think at a certain level does create a disconnect, and that kind of schism then radiates out into other aspects of our life. And then because it's so painful to see, then we actually delude ourselves and ignore the change that we have to make.
And there's a very simple golden rule that underlies all living, which is the golden rule, which is that we should treat all other living beings as we ourselves would want to be treated. And the flip side of that is that everything we do, to each other, to the other animals, to the planet, to everything, is what we're doing to ourselves, ultimately. It's just what you said, Kevin. It's the bottom line. So everything changes for us when we start living by that very simple golden rule. It's terribly simple and hugely straightforward. It is the answer to everything.
Michael, we're down to the last minute. I'd like you to just share your, folks who want to follow up with your work, let them know your website and how they can follow up with you.
Oh, well, I keep a blog at earthintransition.org and write something on it every day about some aspect of what we've been talking about, and there's contact forms and ways of keeping in touch and so on, and delighted to get back to anybody who wants to write in about anything.
And you're also the director of the Kimala Center for Animal Advocacy. What's that website?
That is Kimala, that is K-I-M-M-E-L-A, Kimala.org. And the Non-Human Rights Project, which is very simply nonhumanrights.org. That's a lot of web addresses.
Well, and you also have a Twitter account at Earth Transition, and the Non-Human Rights Project tweets at, I believe it's at Non-Human as well. So there's lots of ways to keep in touch, and we will definitely have you back on the show again. So thank you very much, Michael Mountain, for being with us on The Bridge to Everywhere, and have a wonderful evening, everyone. Good night.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks for having me. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us on The Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links, and resources from our guests and show topics.